This is the Historian's Podcast, and our topic is 19th century American poet Emily Dickinson of Amherst, Massachusetts, who was an avid gardener. And our guest is Marta McDowell. Thank you for joining us, Marta.
Hello, Bob.
Marta McDowell lives, writes, and gardens in Chatham, New Jersey. Marta's books follow the relationship between the pen and the trowel, that is, authors and their gardens. Marta joined us in 2017 to discuss the relationship between gardening and author Laura Ingalls Wilder. Marta McDowell's latest book, Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life, explores, of course, the plants and places that inspired the poet Emily Dickinson. The new full-color book is a revised edition of Marta's first Emily Dickinson volume, which was published in 2005. If you, speaking to the podcast listener, if you were to visit the Emily Dickinson Museum in Amherst, Massachusetts, you can stroll the grounds with a landscape audio tour that Marta scripted. Marta was the 2018 Gardener-in-Residence at the Emily Dickinson Museum. What was that like?
It was wonderful to see it all the way through the seasons, Bob. Normally, I go up to the museum and work in the garden with a group of volunteers in June. And that I've been doing, I guess it's decades now. But this time, I went up about once a month from April through October. And I got to see it from, you know, fairly early spring right till frost. So that was just a treat.
Now, the museum, what is that? Is that the house where she lived?
Yes, it's the house. It's on Main Street in Amherst, Massachusetts. It's a house her grandfather built. Emily Dickinson was born there, and she died there. And she lived there all of her 55 years, except for a period. Her father moved when she was a child, so her teenage years and into her 20s, she lived around the block about maybe a quarter mile away.
Mm. And Emily Dickinson really didn't become famous until after her death, and in fact, maybe long after her death?
Not too long. She died in 1886, and after she died, she'd asked her sister to burn all of her personal papers. This, you know, was not an unusual request. And her sister, Lavinia, did burn all of the letters that Emily Dickinson received through her lifetime, which for a historian or a researcher is really tragic. Mm-hmm. But she saw these booklets of poems that her sister had sewn together and, you know, written out by hand and made these handmade books full of poems. And even her sister had no idea of the number of poems that she'd written. So, you know, Emily Dickinson wrote something like 1,700 poems. And so her sister couldn't burn them. She just said, I had this Joan of Arc feeling. And so she takes it around and eventually finds someone really interested in editing them. And it comes out 4 years after Emily Dickinson's death, the first edition of poems. And it was popular from the start.
Hmm. But it was highly edited from the start. And that applied, did it not, to the poems that, the few poems maybe, that were published during her lifetime in newspapers and things?
Yes, editors have this way. You know, they want the spelling to be correct. They want the punctuation to be regular. And in some cases, they want the rhyme scheme to be regular for poets back in those days. And so the first editors did prune her work. And, you know, since then, the newer editions, of course, have gone back to the original.
Mm. And she had a big burst in her fame, if you will, in the middle of the 20th century, wasn't it, when an edition of her poems came out basically the way she wrote them?
Yes, it's kind of a long story, but there was a feud about, you know, sort of who owned the poems between the Dickinson family and another family in Amherst. And so really for decades, there was not a complete edition of Emily Dickinson's poems. They would they would each group would sort of bring out an edition of the poems that they had. And so it wasn't, I think, until the 1950s that a complete Emily Dickinson came out, and, you know, sort of everything was smoothed over, as time can do some.
Yes. Marta McDowell joins us. Her book, Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life. I did pick up one, to me, kind of unusual fact about Emily Dickinson and her interest in gardening, which is huge. I mean, she really loved that. But is there a picture? There are some pictures from her time. You know, people were taking those early photographs, but they never. There's never been found a picture of her garden.
It's so true, and you know, it's really difficult because we know that the garden beds, as they are today, aren't exactly the way they were at the time. We know they're roughly in the right position, but a later family had kind of redone the landscape. And so we do the best we can. We have a plant list that I compiled that's now in the book. So we work from that. But there are no pictures. There are pictures of the house. There are pictures of the barn. But there are no pictures of the garden.
Do you think she didn't want to have a picture of the garden?
No, I think photography was very new at the time. In fact, the only photographic image of Dickinson is a daguerreotype. And I just think it wasn't as common to take pictures. And I think her garden was like a family flower garden and vegetable garden. You know, it's like they loved it, but maybe people didn't think that was, you know, kind of worth taking a photograph, unlike the house itself.
You kind of stumbled upon Emily Dickinson before you were really serious about writing and maybe gardening even, right, when you were kind of working in the corporate world?
I was always a gardener, but it was a weekend, you know, it was something I did nights and weekends. It's a great illustration, Bob, of the value of museums. Because I was going across Massachusetts, I was driving and visiting insurance agencies at the time, and I had a spare afternoon where I didn't have a meeting booked. And I just stopped in the rest area on the Mass Pike, and I looked at the brochure rack. You know, what could I do this afternoon that I'd have time to do? And I saw a brochure for the Emily Dickinson Homestead. And so up I went to Amherst. This was in the 90s. And I saw this museum of a poet that I never really understood. I mean, I'd certainly studied some of her poems, but suddenly it became clear that she and I had shared a hobby. And that just opened a door. It really, I mean, in a weird way, Emily Dickinson changed my life. So there you go.
There you go. So you've been, in a sense, working on Emily Dickinson for a long time. You have had other writing projects. But so you've researched this book really over the years?
Yes. Yes, and new things do continue to turn up. Not long ago, maybe within, say, the past 5 years, the museum had decided that they were going to bring the Emily Dickinson bedroom, because she did write a lot of her poetry up in her bedroom, and they were going to take out, you know, closets and doors that had been moved over the years since the Dickinson time period. And so they, you know, kind of took it down to the studs, and they took off a piece of molding and found a little scrap of the original wallpaper.
Mm.
Now, when I first visited, Emily Dickinson's bedroom was papered in this sort of beige and white paisley. You know, it was very dull, you know, just to be perfect if you were wearing a white dress. Mm-hmm. It turns out that her wallpaper was a rose trellis and extremely bright and colorful. It actually is in the book now. It's the chapter splits, is this rose trellis wallpaper. She was writing as though she were out in her garden. And, you know, we don't know, did she actually choose the paper herself? But certainly the period fits for when she lived in the room. So it's been redone, and now it's astonishing.
You mentioned that wallpaper that they picked before they knew what it really was would be good with white. And it's because, right, that she wore white toward the end of her life.
Yes, yes. She had a preference for wearing white. I don't know if she wore white out in the garden. It's certainly not what I wear when I garden. But she did, you know, she was unusual, right? She wore white. She got very reclusive toward the end of her life. No one knows really why. And so those things are not false. It's just that's not the full picture.
And you do write that Emily Dickinson was an avid gardener. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so she did everything from, you know, plant seeds, pull weeds, root cuttings, tend her flowers. She wasn't much of a vegetable gardener. She had a small glass conservatory, really little greenhouse, that was attached to the house that was sort of in between, it was outside the dining room windows, and it opened off of her father's study. So she really gardened year-round. She forced bulbs. So there was plenty to write about because her letters are full of references to her interest in gardens.
When we come back on the Historian's Podcast, we'll have more with Marta McDowell about her book, Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life, and we'll have an Emily Dickinson poem that Marta will read to us that has to do with gardening. We depend on your contributions for financial support to keep going with the Historian's Podcast. Please make a donation online at GoFundMe.com/2019-the-historians or send a donation in the mail. Make the check out to me, Bob Cudmore, and send to 125 Horstman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. Our guest is Marta McDowell. We're talking with her about her latest book, Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life. The Wall Street Journal called the new book a visual treat as well as a literary one. What are some of the visuals in the book?
Well, I chose three different botanical artists from the 19th century, all women, and all women who worked in New England, two from Massachusetts and one from Connecticut. Emily Dickinson knew one of them personally. She was aware of the Connecticut artist because she owned a book by her. And the third she wouldn't have known, but I thought that it really fit nicely with the period and with the plants. So in addition to photographs, it's got a lot of beautiful botanical art that really, I think, fits with the period and the theme of the book.
Mm. And you also have a number of pictures and so forth?
Absolutely. So there are photographs, both old and new. And there are images of her herbarium, which is this collection that she made of pressed plants. So it's a whole album of beautiful pressed flowers that she collected over the years.
Hmm. And because of your interest in gardening and her interest in gardening, I mean, what would you say? What do you know any gardeners like her now? Are you like her in her interests and what she did?
Oh, I think most gardeners share her interests in one way or another. You know, so if you force a hyacinth bulb, you're like Emily Dickinson, right? So there is a lot to share. And sometimes I think we put not just poets and artists, but people who lived at earlier times. We sometimes think they're really different from us because, you know, they lived in the olden days. But really, they shared all of the same feelings and passions. They just didn't have as many electronic gadgets.
We had discussed this before we started our recording. I asked you if you would read an Emily Dickinson poem to us that has you know something that's in your book. Apparently, you put it in your book. And one thing I noticed that in the first line, you talk about marl, M-A-R-L. What is that?
Yes, marl is a kind of limestone. So the way you know most of us might spread some lime on our lawn, marl was a very common soil amendment in the 19th century, and they used it on fields.
Mm-hmm.
So, Marl was mined. That's where, for example, I'm from New Jersey. There's a Marlboro, New Jersey, and that is because they mined Marl.
That's something. I mean, I was, you know, I had no idea that's where the name Marl came from. Like, there's a Marlboro, Massachusetts. I always just trace it back to the Marlboro man, to cigarettes.
Yeah, so they mined this sort of whitish, bluish-white soft stone.
Well, anyway, and the poems of Emily Dickinson are not titled, but is this one numbered?
It's not numbered. It wasn't numbered by her, I should say. It's number 558 in the edition of poems that was done in the 20th century, and it was written in 1863. And I chose this today, Bob, because it's autumn. And one thing that happens in the garden in autumn is frost. And so this is a poem that Emily Dickinson writes about frost. And it's, you know, it's almost a tiny bit disturbing. So since we're around Halloween, it fits with that too.
Okay.
So shall I?
Go right ahead.
A visitor in Marl who influences flowers till they are orderly as busts and elegant as glass, who visits in the night and just before the sun concludes his glistening interview, caresses and is gone. But whom his fingers touched and where his feet have run and whatsoever mouth he kissed is as it had not been.
How about that?
How about that, right? That doesn't sound like some virginal person wearing white and standing up, staring out her bedroom window.
I know. Well, and people have written all kinds of speculation about Emily Dickinson, but she appears to have had, at least internally, you know, this great life. I mean, this, I don't mean great in terms of being famous and whatnot, but a very interesting life.
Yes, a recent scholar called her the networked recluse, right? So yes, she was reclusive at the end of her life especially, but she was very well connected with people. A Dickinson friend of mine said she definitely would have been someone who texted a lot. And earlier in her life, she would have loved Instagram, right? So you have to think of her as a person like that. She was always connected with people, even though she didn't always see them.
Mm-hmm. Like toward the end of her life, when people came to the house, because other people lived in the house too, right? She wouldn't go see them. She wouldn't come out of her room, or she'd sort of peek at them through a door.
But she would communicate. So she'd, you know, if someone would play the piano in the parlor, she'd send the maid in with a tray that might have a little poem or a flower on it or a glass of sherry. And she'd probably send them a note the next day or maybe that day. And sometimes she'd enclose a poem in that. So, you know, again, she had very intimate connections with people. And no one really knows why she stopped seeing people face to face, although lots of people, you know, speculate. But
and she was, I mean, her father was a lawyer, right? I mean, is that the source of the family money?
Yes. So her father was a lawyer, and he was also a politician, and he bought land. You know, he made his way back. His father had been a lawyer, but had gone bankrupt in actually financially supporting Amherst College when it was getting started. And he kind of over-mortgaged and then couldn't pay up. And so he ended up actually moving to Ohio.
So was Emily Dickinson like short of cash at the end of her life? Is that not so?
No, I think her father left them comfortable. So neither she nor her sister married. Her brother did marry and live next door. But she and her sister spent the rest of their lives in the family homestead and both died there. But they had household help till the end of their lives. So I think that they were fairly well set up.
And Emily Dickinson was especially friends with her brother's first wife, right? 'Cause they...
Yes, with Susan, Sister Sue. So Susan Gilbert was a family friend that Austen began to court and then eventually married. And Emily Dickinson shared about 200 of her poems, 200 out of going on 2,000, with Susan, and dedicated some of those to Susan. So they were very close. They seemed to have sort of a falling out towards the end of their lives.
Really?
But
Now, back to the gardening, and Martha McDowell with us, author of Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life. Apparently she studied botany when she went to school?
Yes. So Emily Dickinson attended a high school, Amherst Academy, and then she also attended Mount Holyoke for 1 year. And she studied botany. Her textbook was one called Familiar Lectures on Botany, and it was written by a woman, Mrs. Lincoln. Mrs. Lincoln was, I think for a long time, the principal of Troy Academy.
Mm.
And so she wrote this book about botany, particularly sort of targeted at teaching botany to young girls.
Mm-hmm. And she used the language of botany in her poems.
Yes, yes. So you'll find words like calyx and corolla appear in Dickinson's poem. She writes about seeds and roots. And so you can imagine, she was, very voracious as a reader, and she must have had an incredible mind for language, because she'll put these words in various places where they really fit. Of course, she's using them also metaphorically, so you can read the poems at a couple of levels, right? You can read A Visitor in Marl is just about frost on her garden, but A Visitor in Marl can also be, someone or some feeling that's not connected to horticulture.
What do calyx and corolla mean?
So calyx, if you think of a rose, the calyx is that part that sort of, those little things that hang down, there's green from the bud and underneath the flower. The corolla is all of the petals itself, or themselves. So she once talks about the sun and the corolla of the sun being like a flower, right? And if you think of the way, we picture the sun, we do sort of think about it in that floral image.
Mm-hmm. And plants appear in her poems. What do they represent?
Oh, sometimes plants, flowers, bouquets, sometimes just talking about them as though they were poems themselves. She talks about my garden like the beach, fetches her flowers, like the tides coming in the summer garden, right? It's a very vivid image.
Hmm. As a young woman, she collected and pressed flowers. Why did she do that, or why did people do that then?
Well, it was a popular hobby in the day, but like now you might find young girls doing something like scrapbooking, or there'll be a craze for making bracelets in some certain way. It's like it was a fad at the time, but it was also considered a scientific pursuit. This is still kind of the Age of Enlightenment, sort of continuing on into the 19th century. And so it was a pastime that she shared with her friends as well. So she would enclose geranium leaves or flowers and send them on to her friends for their herbarium. Mm. So it's not a hobby that most people pursue today. If you prepare herbarium specimens, you probably work for a botanic garden or an arboretum.
Mm. Did any of those, the pressed flowers, survive?
Yes. In fact, Harvard has the whole album of pressed flowers. It's in the Houghton Library, and they do make it available online. It's so delicate that basically no one other than the curators ever see it, but they've photographed it beautifully, and you can look at it on the Houghton Library website.
And Emily Dickinson was also I say interested is not a strong enough word. Was she obsessed with death?
Well, she writes a lot about death. In a way, I think she had a very healthy attitude about death because she thought about it so much. You know, most of us think, oh, well, you know, death, that's something that's going to happen to all those other people.
Mm-hmm.
She did, when her family didn't live on Main Street but lived around the corner on North Pleasant Street, it was actually adjacent to West Cemetery. So I do think, like, in her formative years, and this was before she was writing a lot of poems, she would have seen a lot of burials. You know, it was a fact of life. You know, she lived through the Civil War, so many of her death poems that happened during that period, we believe strongly that they're about the Civil War, like Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers, because she knew young men who were going off to war, and some of them didn't come back. And so was she obsessed with death? I don't know. But she certainly thought about it a lot and wrote about it a lot. But, you know, sex and death, that's what people write about.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, I don't know if this makes sense or not, but did more people die then? I mean, more people died young. I mean, it seems like she encountered a number of, and then there was the Civil War, which always involved Americans, and maybe she knew more of people who had died than an average person would today.
That's quite possible. I mean, there certainly was more infant mortality. There was more childhood death. One of her nephews died quite young of typhus. And the garden, you know, the garden has this sort of death and resurrection
yes.
cycle, and she writes about that a lot. So, but anyone who gardens, you know, you have annual plants that don't come back. You have perennial plants that die back to the ground. You have plants that, if they are visited by frost, they are dead.
Right.
So it brings it to mind.
And in terms of her own life and death, she was 55 when she died in 1886?
Yes, that's right.
Was that old for that time? Or
Well, her brother and her sister both lived much longer than in their 50s. She did have some health problems, and, you know, no one really knows exactly what they were. We know that she had severe eye trouble in her sort of middle to later years, and her diagnosis that her death was Bright's disease, which is a kind of kidney disease. But again, was that true, or was that what the doctor wrote on the death certificate?
And is the museum in Amherst open year-round?
Yes, it's open year-round. Check the hours, because they do change in the winter. And it's not just her home. It's also her brother and sister-in-law's home next door. And so it's quite an interesting pairing, because while the homestead itself has a sort of sparse furnishing, some original, some not. Her brother and sister-in-law decorated their house in very high Victorian, and sort of when it was finally turned over to a trust, they kind of locked it up with all the stuff in it. And so it's like a time capsule. And so you have this, you know, the poet's house that's been, you know, meticulously being restored. And then you have this amazing kind of time capsule next door at the Evergreens.
Marta McDowell is author of Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life. You've been listening to the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore.